Brainstorm Brewery is brought to you by GatheringMagic.com and CoolStuffInc.com. Show your support. Welcome, everyone, to another special episode of Brainstorm Brewery. We're here at episode 112, going deep into those triple digits. And we got a very special episode because we brought along a guest, a very esteemed artist here. I'm sure everybody knows about him. You've seen his altars around, and he actually did something for Brainstorm Brewery. If you take a look at the zombie token, you'll see the name of Eric Klug on there. Thank you for joining us, Eric.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Marcel, and everyone else. I tell you, I can never get over Marcel's voice. It's just so pleasing to the ears.
Isn't it though?
That's the secret. That's the secret.
I really
to the
missed
cast.
Yeah,
Marcel's
really
the reason we made it over 100 episodes. Like,
Yep.
And then in 150 episode, my voice goes to a shrilly girl. That's the end of my contract with my voice. So I gotta renew that one. So we got a very lively episode, actually. There's been big announcement with Magic. So there's going to be some changes coming along, and we're talking about serious changes. And these are actually changes that I have not heard actually negative criticism. I could think of very minor, you know, blips around here, but honestly, this is by and large, everyone has enjoyed this. And then we're also, since we got Eric on, we're going to talk about some alters and Cube, because, I got bit by the Cube bug recently playing in Portland. Just solidified how much I love playing Cube, and I'm going to start my own. So I'm actually going to own physical cards in a little bit. So, this is weird for me.
Aren't you glad you sold out before?
Hey, at least I had 200 cards I could save around. I'll be all right, I think. It's heartbreaking, but this is all right. You know, I still got my Moto collection.
Yep. So, I know, and you're getting into paper Magic. I'm getting more serious about MTGO. I just bought into Standard on there again.
Man.
Crazy. We're getting bit by the playing Magic bug. We're not supposed to do that, right?
That's pretty weird, actually.
We get yelled at for doing that.
Next thing I have 10 EDH decks. That is my response to that.
That's like the only thing I can play anymore is EDH.
Next thing you know, Corbin's going to give up more folks and he's going to play Goblins.
That would be blasphemy.
All right. So you guys want to jump into this? Who wants to talk about the announcement?
We're going to start it off on the big talk, huh? Where do we want to start in the announcement?
Corbin's like, that's not the order on the show notes. He's scrambling.
Let's go jump into Eric then, to start with that.
Sure.
Correct, Jason.
But that could be completely cut out, the power of editing.
It doesn't have to be cut out, though. We could just leave it in. Also the power of editing.
Yeah.
We should cut this, though.
We'll decide.
We're talking about whether we're cutting it. This goes on longer, we'll have to leave it.
Shut up.
The struggles behind the scenes.
So, Eric, please tell us about it. So, you do alters. If people haven't seen, where's your blog?
I have a blog. It's klugalters.blogspot.com. I don't update that nearly as regularly as my Facebook, which is facebook.com/klugalters. That's KLUG.
Yeah, so check it out. Like, the only way you're going to see it, you have to see it to believe it, because he has some amazing stuff out there. And so how long have you been doing alters, and how did you get started doing?
Believe it or not, I've been doing it since 2008, I guess. So 6 years. I've told the story a million times, so forgive your listeners if they've heard it before. But I came back from Korea. I was teaching English there for a year with my now wife, and I needed a job. So for a while there, I was looking for a job and simultaneously doing alters for just like a little money on the side, and it kind of just snowballed into my full-time job because it was, you know, business was good, and business continues to be good, so I keep altering cards.
Did you learn art before?
Yeah, I have an art degree. I graduated in 2008. I've been doing art pretty much my entire life since like first grade or even earlier than that.
So how did the, tell us, how did it come about the first time, you know, you pick up, you know, is it a marker or a paintbrush or what, and say, you know what, I want to paint on a Magic card. You know, how did that, you know, how did you actually get into that part of it, just knowing that it's what you wanted to do?
Sure. There was a community online of artists that were already doing it. So it wasn't actually my like original idea to start painting on a Magic card, but I was already a Magic player and doing other sort of art projects. So it seemed kind of like a natural marriage to put the two together. So, yeah, I saw some other people's work online. And at that point, probably around 2008, a lot of the work wasn't nearly as sophisticated as it is now. Just really kind of basic alterations. Mm-hmm. Mostly extensions, like the stuff that you see a lot of people starting out with. So I just tried it out. I went home after I saw it and picked up, some acrylic paints because I wasn't actually an acrylic painter before this.
Hmm.
And just, you know, tried my hand at it. And I had some crude results just starting out, but over the years I've refined, you know, my technique and I think I have a good handle on it now.
Now recently you posted a wall of blossoms and compared it to a wall of blossoms from, 2014. Now that older one, let's preface this by saying it's anything I'll ever be able to paint in my whole life if I start training now. But it did not look like an Eric Klug 2014 altar. What year was that that first one from?
Yeah, that was 2008, and that was actually the first card that I did when I came home and bought the paint and everything. And the funny thing is I traded that to a friend shortly after I did it in 2008. He subsequently traded it to someone at one of like the early SCG like 5Ks, like before they even had the open series.
Mm-hmm.
And then just recently a guy commissioned some work from me and he sent the card that he was commissioning along with that original wall of blossoms back to me with a note that said like, hey, I picked this up in a trade like a year ago. It's just been sitting in my binder. I thought, you know, it would mean more to you than it would mean to me. So it was pretty sweet. Yeah,
that's
so
awesome.
Like my original altar came back to me and that kind of inspired me to go back and like try the same card again.
That's a great story right there.
Yeah, it kind of like choked me up a little bit. It was like a really nice gesture from him and I've definitely, you know, done a lot of work for him since. So we have a good working relationship now. It was awesome.
So who are some of the other artists out there that you see and you respect and you think are cutting edge and doing great things in altars?
In altars?
Yeah.
Well, I always refer to like the Europeans. There's Sandra Lean, which most people will know if they look at any sort of altars online. She's in France. And then there's another guy, who goes by Big Up from Germany. I think those two are like the big names that they're doing really quality work. And then, actually if you, Mike Linneman just came out with an article, either tonight or a couple days ago on like some like up and coming altarists that he's been seeing. And, I've been checking a lot of their work and yeah, it's kind of crazy. There's like a lot of talent out there that people aren't aware of. I think I'm pretty fortunate because I started off early and I'm decent at marketing myself. But there's a lot of talented artists out there that they don't know how to get their work out there. And people are just unaware of them because of that, even though their work is awesome.
So what's your opinion about proxies and people doing these altered proxies that's going on or digital art?
The digital proxies that I see online, like the guys that are mass producing them on eBay, like I'm not a super big fan of. I mean, ultimately they can do what they want before, you know, anyone tries to sue them or, you know, for using copyrighted images or something. Honestly, I lean towards not caring, you know, just kind of paying attention to like what's going on in my life. But yeah, I mean, I'm not a fan. I would never play with them for the most part. Like I like seeing original stuff, but like RK Post, you know, he does a lot of, drawings and altars at events he goes to sign. And, like he did a set of like power proxies, I think last weekend. And I thought those were really cool because they were all like original pieces. So, you know, that's like a neat, unique piece to add to your collection.
Well, what is your opinion on when you see some of your alters for sale on eBay?
I think it's awesome. I mean, part of my business, I think, is kind of ensuring my customers that, like, their cards will have resale value. I think there's a lot of misinformation that goes along with alters that they, like, drastically decrease the value of the card. And I don't think that's true as long as the work is done well. And so, like, when I see my cards go up on eBay and they're selling for as much as they were commissioned for, or maybe even a little more than they were commissioned for, plus, you know, the price of the unaltered card, that, like, that just validates that, you know, altering is actually adding value.
Yeah, I've heard that you've gotten hate mail for altering Black Lotuses.
I got one really strange email, like, a couple years ago that was, it just started with, like, probably like 50 question marks, like no like Dear Eric or anything, it was just 50 question marks, and then it said like, do you know what you just did, like you altered a, and then it, he like shot out this really random number, like $15,000 or something. And I was just like, I didn't know a Black Lotus could be worth $15,000, you know, especially a beat unlimited one. So yeah, I've only gotten that one mail. I thought it was pretty funny though. There's definitely that subset of people who will like comment on like Facebook photos or Twitter posts that, you know, they lean towards not altering power. But in the end, you know, like I've been doing this for 6 years. I've only altered 9 Lotuses in 6 years. So I'm far from like, you know, altering all the power that exists in the world.
Dude, tell me about that first Lotus. When you get in, you're like, oh man, I've got, you know, this thousands of dollars that I'm about to start painting on. A little different than, you know, altering somebody's, you know, $5 EDH commander, right?
Sure, sure. I mean, there's definitely a little bit more care put into it, but not as much as you'd think. The first Lotus was actually my first piece of power. I altered a Lotus before I altered any of the Moxes or any like Ancestral or Walk. Mm-hmm. And I ran the idea, the concept by the guy. I mock up everything in Photoshop, so I know what the finished piece should look like roughly.
Right.
And the client knows too. And so, the other part of it is that if you make a mistake when you're painting, you can actually like correct mistakes fairly easily. You can either wipe off the paint when it's still wet, or you can remove it very gently and like using other techniques. So, people think like, you know, like what happens if you screw up? And it's like, well, if I screw up, I'm just going to fix it. It's not going to be that, you know, difficult, you know?
It's not like doing a crossword puzzle in pen.
Right, exactly.
So do you like it when people come with ideas? Do you like to flesh out ideas with people? How's the creative process in there?
I definitely say like flesh out ideas. I do like when people come with a little bit of a concept, because I tell them ultimately I want the card to be something they're going to enjoy. You know, like my artistic taste doesn't necessarily mesh with everybody in the world. So, yeah, I tell them to like, you know, what are you interested in? If they're like, I'm just going to give you carte blanche on this. And I'm like, please don't do that, because it's like really stressful. Yeah. So once I get kind of a basic idea, I can give them suggestions on like how to approach a certain concept and like what would look best and how, things like that.
What things do you dread doing, or that you just are so cliche that you're tired of doing?
I don't do personal portraits anymore. Not because I don't think they have any merit, but mostly because I just don't enjoy doing them. And if I don't enjoy doing the work, then the work suffers. And so I've just told people, you know, very honestly that like, I'm not going to enjoy doing this commission. So, you know, I can recommend some other people who would probably do a better job doing it.
I was going to ask, how far out are you booked?
I try to book myself only out like a month at a time. So, I'd say about a month, maybe a little bit more. After Gen Con, I got pretty slammed, because I was like, I tried to clear out my queue as much as possible before Gen Con. And then I just told people to like hit me up when I was getting back. And when I got back, I was answering like 15, 20 emails a day.
Success sounds good and tiring.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a blessing and a curse for sure.
So how did you get into Cube? Where did this fall into the Ultra Plan?
Cube happened probably 2003-ish, 2004, with Tom LaPilli, who works for Magic R&D. And he didn't work for Magic R&D at the time. We were both in high school. And he came back from, I don't know, some event, like a Grand Prix, and said, you know, I have this, I learned about this new format called Cube. And he explained the basic format, and it was the same as it is today. And he picked up cards over the subsequent weeks, and me and a couple friends and Tom were like the first to really try out his cube. And when I went to college in 2004, I decided to just, you know, I want to build my own cube because I thought it was really fun. I had drafted Tom's a couple times, and it just kind of snowballed from there. And now I have four cubes.
Now the cube that comes to mind when I think Eric Klug is your Pro Tour cube, where every card in the cube was in a deck that won a Pro Tour event. Is that correct?
That is correct.
How big is
the
cube?
So what can you tell me about? Yeah, how big is that now?
The cube is about 750 cards.
Oh, okay.
That's my favorite. This is my favorite one of you know, all the cube ideas. I love this idea.
Yeah, I'll tell you a little bit about the origin. So what happened was, so I don't take full credit for it. Sam Black on Twitter said, wouldn't it be cool if there was a cube where it was like every card from every Pro Tour top eight deck? And, I think BDM at that point jumped in and was like, that seems like a lot of cards. Like, what if it was one copy of every card from every winning deck? And, it was like kind of, you know, as Twitter goes, like a day long conversation. And, I think everybody kind of just left it at that. But then, Jarvis Yu, who is like a Marylander and he's, you know, runs the Grand Prix circuit and occasional Pro Tour appearances. He's like, you should just build this thing. And I told him I'll build it if you, you know, donate a bunch of cards. So what we did was Patrick Chapin actually put together the list maybe a couple days later. So that saved me a lot of trouble of trying to put together a list for the cube. And once that was done, I just kind of put out the word to friends in the Maryland area that I was building this cube and I needed help because there's a fair amount of value in the cube. I mean, there's also such all-stars as like Canyon Wildcat. But yeah, so we put together the cube fairly quickly, maybe in a couple of weeks. And, now it's fully complete and every Pro Tour I get to add like 5 to 10 cards. And I mean, that's that. It's pretty sweet. It's one of my favorite cubes next to my common uncommon cube. It kind of battles for like first position in terms of like when, how much I get to draft it.
You're complaining about adding Quicken to this cube on Twitter?
Well, okay. So here's the deal is because I don't get to curate the cube, you know, the cube is dictated by what cards win a Pro Tour. It's very, it's color imbalanced. So blue has the most cards, no surprise, at like, 130, and black has like 67 cards. So, and I think red might have even less than that. So, last Pro Tour, I really wanted anyone but the blue deck to win. There was only one blue deck in the entire top eight. You know, there was two mono black decks, or I guess Owen and Huey's deck was black slash white. So I was kind of rooting for them to win so that we could add more black cards to the cube. Sperling would have been good if he won because of all the red cards. But yeah, of course the only blue deck wins and now I just have to pile on more blue cards. So, I mean, Flock ended up adding, you know, a couple of cool cards. Elixir of Immortality is interesting. But, yeah, in the end I was just kind of like frustrated. Like, this isn't what it needs.
Yeah.
But,
do you have that sideboard? Are the sheep going into your cube?
Yeah, no sideboards.
Oh man. Yeah, no justice for the sheep. No sheep.
Well, it definitely gives you a different rooting interest. It's definitely a new rooting interest at the, you know, when you're watching the top eight, that's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, the problem with sideboards too is there's already a bunch of like, there's already some like metagame cards that are in the main decks of most of these decks. Like, for example, there's a Rebel Informer in this deck in the cube. And that card just literally does nothing. There's six rebels in the entire cube.
That's a lot of rebels.
Oh yeah, but going back to your comment, it definitely adds to the rooting, like you said. I'm definitely way more interested on Sunday now because I have a vested interest in who wins, even if it's like just no one I know.
Right.
So people, you know, people want to get into Cube. I'm getting into Cube right now. I got bit by the bug in Portland, and it's a good addiction to have, I think. So what are some advice for people starting out getting a Cube or interested in going into this rabbit hole?
Well, first of all, Marcel, I'm very excited that you're getting into Cube. You were talking about it before we started recording, and I'm anxious to hear what this Cube is going to look like. But yeah, for Cube is great because it's like the perfect marriage of competitive Magic and casual Magic. I am not a huge fan of like multiplayer games or super casual formats. I like the competitive aspect of the game, but I don't really play a lot of Constructed anymore because it takes a lot of effort to keep up with.
Yeah.
So Cube really supplies, you know, everything I need. I would say the one thing if you're looking to build a Cube is look at other people's lists. If you're trying to build like just a normal rare Cube, look at examples of that. If you want something that's a little more budget, you can build like a common uncommon Cube like I've built, which worked out really well when I was in college. That's the reason I built that Cube to start with, was because I didn't have a huge budget when I was in college. But yeah, just, I mean, people have done the work for you. So go online and look at that work, you know, because you'll save yourself a lot of time and playtesting by, you know, basing your Cube off someone else's.
Yeah, I got some, a decent idea of where to go. I'm not going to have any swords. I'm going to get some, I want to put moxes in, but I don't want to put any other power in.
Okay.
And you know, that's duels cool. And all. I'm going to get those all proxied. I know somebody, the proxy guy, I'm going to hit him up and, it'd be like, you know, special one for ones. Cause there's no way I'll put, actual moxes in the Cube and have people play with it. Like, I can't risk a heart attack, you know.
It's pretty stressful, right? That's how we felt every time playing with TSG's Cube in Portland.
Yeah.
Draft a Lotus and you're like, God, I sure hope like nothing crazy happens.
You were more stressed than him.
Yeah. You don't want to drop it down.
I was. Yeah. Like,
but like there's one
and
time
at the end of the night. At the end of the night, we're missing a card and you're just like, oh my God, like, you know, I had all my stuff put together, but what if it's a card I had? You know, you just feel terrible. And then it ends up being a Gideon's Lawkeeper. But still.
For me, like, if it were my Cube, I would freak out because I've watched a Cube get vomited on, so I definitely wouldn't trust people I met at an event.
Has this story been told on the podcast?
It was the Boost Cube.
Yeah. It was the Boost Cube in Vegas, so.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that makes a lot more sense.
It's conducive to it. I think he learned that maybe instead of sleeving, he should laminate.
He could just print it on plastic cars, you know, so you could dunk them in the sink.
That's not, you just hose off the Cube at the end of the night.
That's exactly. Yeah, that's probably like the best idea.
Wipe it down with Windex. Yeah.
It's going to be semi-powered. I don't want it completely powered. I think, there's too much, if you get too much on the top end, it's not as fun and some cars don't get the shine. I want to be able to have like turn and burn and far and away to be playable.
Sure.
And I'm no swords and no GTA, but Battle Skull will be in there. So I don't know, just semi powered, but it's just, you know, it's really fun. And people have not played Cube and haven't got to try it. It's just like, you know, you get to play with all these cards from Magic's past and being able to put them together and make it work and find these synergies.
Yeah, that sounds actually really reasonable. I haven't actually heard of many people doing like a semi powered thing with like the moxes, but it seems like what you're trying to do should work. Like, you know, the most busted power cards are like Lotus, you know, I consider Sol Ring a power card. You know, Ancestral, Time Walk. Those are cards that are sometimes hard to come back from, but someone having like a turn one Mox, you can definitely eat those draws.
Yeah, it feels good to play with it and it's kind of exciting, but yeah, you could beat the draws and later on in the game, they're just like a land. So right. it doesn't get insane. So,
and like you said, it's like representative of like Magic's first year too, which is kind of cool.
And then, yeah, I wanted to do a lot of bounce. I'm a big fan of like momentary blink, so I was going to incorporate like that into the blue. White would be a lot, you know, more token base. And so do you want to split it up like control and aggro in the colors and Like, how do you balance out the creatures? Do you give blue less creatures, more spells, or?
Yeah, what I do is, what I tell people is just build the cube. Try to, I would say, like, keep the colors balanced, you know, figure out what numbers you want for the colors, like, if it's 50 of each card or 60 of each color, rather. And then look at, like, your spell creature distribution. So it's not like, I don't know, like, it has, if you have, like, 60 of each color and, like, that color has 50 spells and 10 creatures, like, that's probably not gonna work. But for the most part, things sort of work out, like, on their own. Like, archetypes will develop on their own without you really, like, fumbling with them. Like, if you just add the cards that you want to play with or you think are good, yeah, like, the cube should evolve or develop on its own.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'm using Cube Tutor. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Cube Tutor, you could put all the cards there and you could actually draft it and everything. If people don't know about this, it's like cardboard crack. It's, you know, being able to draft a cube. So this is a good way to put your cube that you're building through the ringer and, you know, try stuff out. So another idea out there for people.
I mean, building the cube is like, I don't know, at least half the fun, if not, you know, more than half the fun. So I would just say, like, the cube's not going to be perfect in its first incarnation, and you really just have to play it to work out the kinks. But other than that, you know, it's like, that's all, like, really fun work to do.
Yeah. It's not work if it's fun.
Right.
All right. So, do you want to get to the meat of this? The big announcement?
The big announcement.
Corbin, you're good for this. Break it down to us.
Well, let me see if I get this right here. Wizards had a few problems with the way Standard would play out recently. And we've all seen it, you know, with the proliferation of tournaments every weekend, Grand Prix every weekend, the Standard metagame would get figured out very quickly. You know, the third set is another problem that they had where people didn't, the third set was very difficult to deliver on and make people happy, and, you know, make it new. Okay. So those were two of the main problems they wanted to tackle. The third one was that the core set, you know, is traditionally not super loved, even though core sets are much better now than they used to be. So the way that they decided to tackle all these problems at once was to create a second rotation for the year. We will have our current rotation in October, like always. There will be an additional spring rotation moving forward. All blocks will now be two sets only, and they will come out in the fall and the winter. It will be one block, and in the spring and the summer will be another block. So along with the, you know, the two rotations and the shorter blocks, it kind of changes up the way that things work. You know, it's Standard changes more often. So you don't get beat by the same cards for a year. You know, we don't have, Mutavault all over the place forever or Jund, back in the day, you know, just destroying people for 2 years, that sort of stuff. So the core set is no more. And instead we're going to have two set blocks. So, you know, there's kind of some funky rotation once we actually, you know, as we move past Cons of Tarkir into the next one, but how it will work once we get there is that you will always have, three blocks, legal and standard at the same time. And there'll be a rotation every 18 months. So that's it in a nutshell right there. And for the first time in recent memory, there was a big change announced by Wizards that people didn't lose their minds over. Seemed like everyone's pretty much on board. What do you guys think?
I lost my mind, but in the most positive way ever. I was like, a dream came true. This is the greatest news ever. And if you want to find out, really, I got to give kudos to whoever made the article and the animated graphics on there. Like, that was absolutely perfect way to just describe it. And if you need to figure it out, go look at Mark Rosewater's article on the Mother site on the 25th. And it pretty much explained it as clear as you needed.
It's certainly a big change, that's for sure.
What do we think this is going to do, guys? Because industry, everyone's looking at us. I've already been on a podcast today already to answer this question. What do we think this is going to do to – is this going to make – let's look at Standard. Is Standard going to be more or less affordable?
I think it's going to be more affordable. I don't think it lets cards as easily get to that $40, $50 range. Because people aren't like, oh, this is going to be in Standard for 2 years. The shorter you make a card's life in Standard, if it is a Standard-only card, the less likely it is going to be able to dominate a format for long enough, especially since a lot of the cards need other pieces that are currently printed. And if some of those are leaving in 6 months, then how long does that card really have to dominate that format? And it usually takes, you know, people to view, okay, this is going to be good even after rotation for it to hold that kind of value. Like, you know, would Voice of Resurgence been good at all if the deck that it was going to be okay in was rotating right out? Like, would it have ever been $40?
Well, okay. I mean, that's one way to look at it. Another way of looking at it is that because they have a shorter lifespan, everything will just happen as the same, but it will just move faster because you don't have as much time for that supply to hit the market. Because you don't have Theros, you know, say we're using this one. You don't have Theros being open as long. You have Theros being open, and then you have your winter set being opened, and then, you know, you have your journey into Nyx, but that's an entirely new block. So that second set of each block, the winter set and the summer set, are basically your new third set. And I don't know if those cards are, if you open up two Theros and one Born of the Gods, and then 3 months later you don't open up any of that stuff, well, that's not a whole lot of those second set cards on the market. I think you could actually see some more of those really expensive jumps just on because of the supply end of things. You know, like Ryan said, I don't think they sit there as long. But you know, those, you'll have more instances of Boros Reckoner hitting $30, I think, after this change.
Because the draft on Modo matters too, because Redemption will be affected by that.
To be fair though, Corbin, like the two points you're trying to make aren't connected at all, because you're saying that the supply, like Boros Reckoner hit that price when the supply was brand new. It wasn't down the road. And that really had nothing to do with the shortage of the supply being open. It was just because the set was brand new and none of the cards had been opened that much.
Right.
Yet. And
people just needed Boros Reckoner. You're right. You're right. I think it is better laid out as two separate points. One, you will have a smaller supply of each card because sets will not be opened for as long of its time period. Two, because you have more changeover in standard, you will have more breakout decks at Pro Tours because it will be vastly changing, every 6 months now. So I think that's where you get that Boros Reckoner effect, is where something breaks out. And, you know, in one sense, maybe Boros Reckoner is the right thing to say, but because those cards will be open for a less period of time, maybe a card from the winter set doesn't do a lot, okay? And then rotation happens in the summer. And at that first Pro Tour, that card from the winter set breaks out, okay?
Yeah,
but you open that up for as a one of in a draft for 3 months, and now it's breaking out later, and you have that low supply. Like I said, I think it just leads to a lot more spikes just because there's more change and there's lower supply.
Yeah, it's mostly for the small sets. That's where you're going to see it most, and you're still going to have the small set problem just magnified on both of them. But you're not going to have the core set problem now where people are underdrafting the core set, and that's going to be more balanced out. And I think just because the way that the people are going to be more interested in drafting more.
I think that's true. But because, yeah, that you, it, it for, on their end, you know, if you look at it from Wizards' point of view, it kind of normalizes things throughout the year, rather than having, a big push in the fall and into the winter, and then kind of a lull in the spring and the summer. I think it normalizes it for them throughout the year in terms of players being excited. You know, from a player's perspective, and I assume from Wizards' perspective, it's great. You know, it's an awesome change. And from a financial perspective, I think it offers more opportunities.
Yeah, because there's more, every time it's rotation, you know, you're shaking up the format. It gives you an opportunity to see what's good, what cards are coming out, what plays well. So, like, if you're a seasoned speculator and you can actually make good calls, or you know what's going on, like this is like the Wild West. This is perfect.
Yeah,
I mean everything's gonna move much faster.
I think people will brew more too, because if Restoration Angel had been an Innistrad, it actually probably would have made Magic entirely miserable. Like, the fact that everyone just, like, sat on that card and they're like, well, we'll play Innistrad Restoration Angel with all the cards from the block before Innistrad, and then Restoration Angel with all the cards in the block after Innistrad, and we'll play Restoration Angel every day it's legal until it's finally gone. You'll have a little bit less of that, with cards only being in standard for 18 months instead of, you know, basically, I'm not going to say ruining standard, but, like, they're cards you get sick of, and you won't
get burned out on Jund. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, even if the decks survive, it's the individual cards are getting shaken up, and I think that's going to encourage people to brew a little bit more.
I think it's going to be interesting. So here's one thing that they've kind of set this subtle undertone with the graveyard theme. And I think this is the perfect example of what this is allowing Wizards to do. So say there's no graveyard theme in cons, right? However, in the, you know, the, I guess the single set and then the core set next year, perhaps there's a huge push towards some sort of graveyard theme. It allows them to set up those, these metagames knowing that like this is going to be an archetype that is viable for a certain amount of time. However, because the M15 core set will be rotating out shortly after that, you don't have, like you were saying, you don't have this year of this necessarily, but it allows them to be able to play around with particular strong archetypes, knowing that that will be a deck type, but knowing that nobody will be necessarily miserable about it because it's only there for 6 months rather than a minimum of a year of it, like it would be now.
Or even 3 months. They could have it on the tail end of the small set and it's only,
yeah,
you know.
Exactly. There's some really cool stuff it lets them do. And I think it's going to be important looking forward. You were talking about how it's a speculator's paradise. Look for those cards that don't quite fit. Like, you know, this card is powerful, but it's just, it doesn't belong in this standard. And those are going to be the kind of cards I think you want to speculate on, because Wizards is going to take full advantage of this ability.
Oh, man. Yeah, because now they get three sets to play with. And it's like, you know, you get the synergy from three different sets, which I really wanted that. The last few standards, like, you know, the three sets of what can overlap. You know, if we get fetches with, you know, like, let's say Ravnica. But one thing I was thinking about, though, is that demand might actually go down in standard cards. Because cards are only going to be around for 18 months, people are going to be more likely to go into the decks that they want to play and not really dip around too far and venturing too far into other decks because they don't want to maintain a large collection because their collection is going to rotate quickly. So I think you're going to see less people hoarding cards, you know, and, you know, that's something I kind of do myself. I try to get as many cards as I can and then sell them out. And I see myself less likely to do that moving forward.
I think you're going to have the people who aren't able to play weekly potentially looking at that, but the people who are playing weekly FNMs, like, this isn't going to change anything for them. You have to be more weary about getting rid of your cards a little bit earlier, but at the same time, you're not setting yourself up for this 3 to 4 month gaps either where you can't play, because the amount of, with this speeding up the process of standard, you're not going to see prices dip down as soon as the last block came out, which would be, you know, 4 months ago or whatnot. It's going to now probably be more like a 2 month gap where prices are really going to change, because that's happening constantly. So if anything, I think it makes standard a little bit safer. What I'm curious to see what happens is any Eternal playable cards, like Corbin hit on it earlier, but talking about how some of these sets aren't going to be open very, very long. For standard, that's fine, but for these Eternal formats, some of these cards are going to be extremely hard to get a hold of, and you're not, I guess, like, I'm concerned that right off of the bat, like, you know, if it's not something that's opened a ton, and then you get that 6 months out and no one's, you know, everyone's done drafting that, is there going to be enough there for Modern to be able to sustain it, especially if it's also standard playable?
But then they need aggressive with Modern Masters and just keep that going on every 2 years and keep
well, I mean, even if we assume that does, like, assume that happens, like, things will,
you're still going to have gaps.
Things will happen, yeah. Like, yeah, you just doubled the number of third sets in a year is what they did.
Yeah. You know, and like, I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it's just something you have to be weary about when you're looking at a set. If you see something that is Eternal playable, I don't think you have the luxury anymore of waiting around for it to drop after standard.
Yeah.
I guess is really the point. I think it's one of those things, if you think it's something you're going to play in Modern and it has a reasonable, you know, even pre-sale price at times, it might be worth just picking up. And I'm not saying you go deep on every card, but you definitely have to look at your Eternal playable cards a little more than you do now. Usually you have like a 3 to 4 month window easily where you can get on these cards at some point really cheap. And some of these cards just aren't going to drop because instantly the Modern playability and the standard playability is going to be there. And after that year and a half time, because it was open in such a short amount, guaranteed, because all cards will be now in some sense, you're not going to have that period where, you know, it drops down even after rotation. Like, I think there's going to be a lot more fluid price changes. I don't think we're going to see the hefty spikes as much, but at the same time, I think the overall ceilings of the both playable, you know, in standard and Eternal cards is much higher than it is now from standard playable.
It could almost be a wash, because everything everybody's saying, when they say, I think prices are going to go up because of this, all, like, really sound logic. And everybody is saying, I think prices will go down because of this, I think it's equally sound logic. I don't know that things are going to change. It probably does, but I don't know that things are going to change all that drastically. I think maybe there will probably be changes in how people have to go about getting their cards, when they have to go about starting to sell the stuff, and, you know, as rotation approaches, I think there will be some changes, but for the most part, I don't think it'll be as drastic as people are worried about. And I think maybe it's because the announcement seems like it's all upside. Everyone's looking for, you know, a downside just because there's got to be one. But this might just be good for Magic.
I think so. I mean, I think if anything, it's going to make, you know, if these prices are actually going up, that just means more people are buying these cards, right? Like, clearly, this isn't going to be good for, this is good for speculators that are going in on targets that are actually playable. This is really going to hurt the market of people who are just trying to inflate cards to inflate cards.
Yeah, I think hoarders are going to get
hurt.
And
I think that's great. I think that's perfect. I think there will be cards where I will pick a couple hundred copies up of, and I will make money on those cards. However, gone are the days where I think you can pick 5,000 copies of a card up, because especially with Standard moving so quickly like that, a lot of these stores aren't going to want that many copies of a card. And I don't know. I think overall it really is all upside. But yeah, I agree. Some cards are going to go up, some cards are going to go down. I think eternal playability is where you really have to watch things going up immediately to start with, and we'll see where the market balances. I mean, nobody really knows. We have nothing to draw on. I know I'll be spending my next year extensively looking at Lorwyn block and Shadowmoor block for price changes and things like that, because that's the only precedence we have for this. And a lot of where I get most of my pricing comes from price history and drawing conclusions from, you know, we've seen most of this before, most of these kinds of sets before, like going into cons, we know that, you know, we've seen shards. So a lot of things are going to be able to mimic that. However, with this new format, we really haven't seen this before outside of Lorwyn. So,
well, I mean, I think that's obviously the best comparison to make. And what have we seen out of Lorwyn? We've seen really expensive cards, and we have seen very expensive uncommons.
But the boxes are expensive too. So, like, if it didn't get opened a ton, why are the boxes expensive if there are more of them than average?
I don't think that's the right way. I mean, obviously there's a lot of different ways to look at this because the player base is super grown since then and all of that. But I mean, I think that the point stands is that, like, and I think it basically just boils down to they created a second, third set every year. So that effect is doubled. I mean, I really think that's all it's going to boil down to.
I mean, that sounds fine.
So, Eric, what do you think about all this?
Man, you guys just kind of, I've been listening very carefully. And, I mean, you guys clearly know this stuff better than I do. When I heard the announcement, I was just like, I was actually like not as interested as I guess I should have been. I mean, and that probably mostly stems because, like, I'm not a huge finance guy and I'm not a huge constructed guy. But most of the announcements that have happened over, like, the past 6 months, almost all of them, it's sort of like a wait and see. And, yeah. And you know, I'm just going to play it by ear. I think it looks like a good change, but I really have to see the results before I make any conclusions.
Well,
yeah.
I think one of the important things is that, like, you know, while, yes, we are talking about the things that could potentially be good or bad depending on your point of view, such as, you know, the as far as prices go, whatever that trade-off is, I'm 99% sure that it's worth it for Magic. That's, yeah, you know, kind of how I would summarize my thoughts on it.
I'd agree with that, for sure.
Yeah, the last few third sets we've been trying to figure out, like, how can they do this correctly? And, you know, Dragon Maze was not that great. I mean, you see what happened with New Phyrexia as far as, like, how expensive cards are. Like, they really figured out something that's going to work out for Magic, and it's going to make Standard interesting. We're not going to have this pit, black hole of just, you know, staleness.
I think the other thing that, like, a lot of people forget when there's these, like, drastic changes that come up are that there are, like, a lot of smart, really, really smart people at Wizards. Especially when it comes to gameplay. So, like, they know what they're doing. So, you know, ultimately, the consensus at Wizards has to be that this is going to be a positive change for the game. And if all of those very intelligent people think that it's going to be a positive change, I'd be willing to bet my money that it's going to be a positive change.
Yeah, exactly.
Bam, so we want to move into the picks of the week.
Email?
No. Marcel's just, like, shooting from the hip. I love that. Corbin's got a well-organized docket.
Oh, we don't believe in dockets. I never heard of a docket before.
I was just making fun of JR, Time Elemental.
I know.
His use of the docket. He really likes to stick to that docket. And Marcel just shoots from the hip, and I really respect that.
I think we should take a quick break and Corbin can give me some advice on what to eat at Buffalo Wild Wings.
Oh. You can't go wrong, right? That's what it really boils down to. Whatever you get there will be delicious.
Why don't you just save yourself 15 minutes and just take the chicken right into the bathroom and put it directly in the toilet?
Yeah, sounds pretty accurate.
He did see Eric had to go through an earlier before episode where we tried to talk Corbin into eating some decent food, and he resisted it because he said, "Why would they upset my ritual of Buffalo Wild Wings?" So there's no hope for this guy.
I just want to eat American food. I don't want to eat food from another country. Is that so wrong?
Wait. But America is a melting pot. What is American food?
It's not like traditional
Vietnamese food from Frankfurt, Germany or American food.
They want me to go eat some like very traditional Vietnamese food or something, and I'm just not feeling that. Like that's just, I don't know. That's scary to me.
What is pizza, Corbin?
Oh my God.
I'll give you this TED talk.
It's
this
very traditional Italian food, and I'm terrified of it.
I get my pizza from Little Caesars.
I want an American hamburger.
Oh man.
That's a very good point. I think the proper way to put it is, it's a very authentic food, which is very different from what I normally eat. That's why, I'm pretty tepid about it.
The thing is that I've listened to the podcast before and everybody gives you shit, Corbin, so I just feel obligated as a guest.
You're doing it right. You're doing it right.
Yeah, most of our guests don't give them shit. So
they say like, you know, when you go to prison, you gotta like beat someone up so that no one has to. I just don't want to be anyone's wife.
Excellent.
Find the weakest guy and make him your bitch.
Basically, that's what's going on here.
On that note, I'm going to read an email before this goes any farther. I have an email here from Justin Waterfield. He says, "Hey guys, lots of love as always. I've built up quite a collection over the years. I started playing during Scars of Mirrodin. My main source of value is modern staples. I have two decks completely built and a lot of other decks partially built. I could use a little bit of cash, and I think I need to realize that I only need one or two modern decks around anyways. So my question is, what is the best way to get the most bang for my buck? If my goal is to sell modern staples as well as various promos and from the vaults, what should he do? He's looking for cash and not credit." He says, "Thanks guys for helping me out. Justin Waterfield." So I mean, basically if he's trying to out modern cards for cash, and not, you know, credit that a lot of places would offer, what do you guys think is his best route for doing that? Should he individually sell these cards? Should he just buy list them or what?
I would sell different cards. Here's what I would do. I would go to my local store. I would go to SCG Opens. I would go to Grands Prix, whatever. I would see if I can't get a little bit of a premium turning modern staples into whatever standard card you want. And if you're willing to do that, like give people cards they want and not care what cards you're getting, all of a sudden they're going to give you a bit of a premium. And if you can do that, you can pick up stuff that is being, has a lower spread on the buy list, and you can sell that for cash instead of selling those staples. So a lot of the times those staples are going to have a better spread, but if you can get a premium and you can get stuff that the dealers are overpaying on, you can actually make quite a bit of money. Well, I didn't sell my dual lands. I didn't sell them on eBay. I didn't do anything. What I did was I told people, I will trade these revised dual lands that you need for legacy and to standard stuff, but I'm going to put buy list numbers on your standard stuff. And they were fine with that, and I, you know, got full cash value for dual lands doing that. So if you find somebody that's willing to trade at a bit of a premium, you can actually, it doesn't matter to you if you're going to treat your cards as dollar signs. It doesn't matter which cards you sell. You're trying to get the maximum value. So do somebody else a service in the meantime and, you know, get compensated for that service. And then you've got the cards to sell, and it doesn't necessarily have to be your cards that you started with. That's what I would do.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really, you know, a really good way to go about it if you have the time to put into that. If you don't, maybe, and you have some of those high-end stuff and you just, you know, don't have, the time to go through, you know, the steps that Jason suggested, start with the local Magic Facebook group or the store, or just let people know that you're looking to sell some cards. And, if anyone happens to be looking to pick up those cards, you can reach this deal where you get better than buy list and they get better than retail. and everybody wins there. You know, outside of that, if you are the type of person who has the patience to list everything one at a time and on eBay or TCG Player and ship them off, you know, that's your next step for making the most money. After that, it probably comes down to a buy list, which is fine. You know, all of these things are a trade-off, you know, more money for more time. So it just kind of depends on where that line gets drawn for you. All right, we've got another email here. This one is from Petrison Teow. He says, hey, Brainstorm crew. My name is Petrison, an intermediate Magic player and beginner financer. I've been listening to the podcast since N13, and it's been really fun and a great help for my financing skills in general. I have a few questions, and I'm going to try to keep them short and sweet. First of all, what does it mean when you use the term trade aggressively? Do you actively seek out said cards for trade? Do you offer more for said cards when you trade for them, or do you grab your trading partner by the collar and yell trade with them? So let's just knock these questions out as we go. What do you guys, you know, when we say trade aggressively for something, how would you describe that?
I mean, I think it's a mix of the first two, actually. There are, I mean, it's a little less now as everyone wants to trade retail to retail, but what I used to use it as was there were certain cards where I usually wanted a premium across the board, like you were just talking about, especially on my higher end cards. However, there are certain standard cards where if I had those dual lands Jason was speaking of, I would trade at straight value because I think those cards are going up that much. And I just, like, I will make those kind of deals just to get as many copies as I can of that. So it's, you're giving a little more value, but at the same time, you're using maybe your stock that you might not use otherwise or that you might want to hold on to or whatever it takes to get those cards off people you're willing to do and willing to trade away.
Yeah, I think for me, it's a lot of times, you know, especially someone who is trying to get ahead in, you know, the finance game or whatever, you sit down with somebody to trade and you let them look through your binder, you figure out what they want, and then you go through their binder and kind of take what you can where everyone's happy and you can make something. Trade aggressively would be where you introduce, you know, the N-word, as Jason calls it, need. You walk up to somebody and say, hey, I really need some prognostic sphinxes. Do you have any for trade? And ask a table that and find somebody to trade with you that way. You know, I think that's kind of the way that I go about that is you actively search out a certain card rather than just trading to trade.
I grab people by the collar and say, trade with me! So
he does. I've seen it. It's terrible.
I believe it. All right, second question. Second question. He says, I hope to play Modern in the future. I have an incomplete set of Ravnica Block Shock Lands, which I hope to be able to complete. Is this the best time to pick these up? And for once, when somebody asks us a question like this, we're not that far off because this email came to us on July 30th. So we are within 30 days here.
Okay. this is actually perfect. I was just talking to somebody about this today, and then Marcel mentioned it earlier with the Cube Talk. I think you you'd finish off your original set. I think Thoughtseize is a great example, as we were talking about earlier. You look at the Lorwyn Thoughtseize comparatively to the new print, it's much, much higher. And I think that that's going to continue for the Shocklands. Even if they reprint the Shocklands again down the road, the ones that will sustain the value are going to be the oldest ones. And, I mean, that's just been proven true for most cards from their original set. There are exceptions, Commander prints and stuff like that. But for the most part, yeah, I think you finish it off, and right now is probably the perfect time. I don't think they're going to go much lower, especially the original Ravnica ones, after rotation. If they do, I think it's going to be such a small part that, you know, if you get in, if you start getting in now to finish out your set, you're probably not going to do it till after rotation anyway. So, yeah, now's a fine time to start. I wouldn't say that you have to rush and get them all right before rotation, but I don't see them dropping enough to not make it worth getting in here pretty quick.
So let's amend this slightly. In case he actually means return to Ravnica, because I think that's a question a lot of people have as well.
Didn't he say original Ravnica?
He said Ravnica Block. You know, a lot of people just refer to to Ravnica as Ravnica.
Right.
Well, but, you know, either way, you've answered one half of the question. What about the second half if he's talking about return to Ravnica? Make sure we have our bases covered.
I think it's still the same case. Like, I think the other ones have more potential for growth. But I think that the Ravnica ones are just fine to get in now. I wouldn't expect you to pick them up this moment, and then before the end of the year they'd be double or anything like that. But I don't think they're going to go down any, and if they do, it's going to be such a small amount that I don't think you're going to be kicking yourself for picking them up now.
Yeah.
And they certainly will be going back up.
I agree. I mean, right now is basically, and it's not like, you know, this drop dead date rotation comes October, whatever, when the new set comes out, and all the previous cards tank. Yeah, those cards are already tanking. In Ravnica, shocks have not super tanked. The last staple land we had that didn't tank at rotation, was the fetch lands. And, you know, obviously they won't have the same growth that fetch lands had, but I think it goes to show that people recognize what cards are eternal staples, and you're not gonna see shock lands just go down at rotation. They're gonna be maybe a buck or two down, if that, you know, very small percentages. So I agree, you pick them up now, it will eventually pay off. You know, eventually there'll be a Modern Masters 2, we assume, and then, hey, you've got another way to get people into Modern, and then they need those, finish out those Shockland sets. So, yeah, I agree. Alright, so let's finish off a final question here. It says, I live in Singapore, and the trading market here is not really as diverse as what you probably have in the States. We don't have regular GPs and PTQs, and as such, there is a lack of large conventions for me to trade cards on a large scale. What is the best way to trade effectively in a community such as this? Thank you so much for reading. Again, the podcast is super fun and educational, and Finance 101 is especially helpful for a beginning player like me. Looking forward to the next episode. So, all right. I mean, none of us have lived in Singapore. So I hope that we can answer your question to the best of our abilities. But what can he do, guys, when there's not a lot of large events going around?
Trade at small events. Like, where do people hang out? Do people mostly play casual? Do people mostly play F&M? Is there a store where people play out? You just gotta be where the people are. And if there's not a big GP, then you don't trade at a big GP, but I would say most of the trading I do is local now, you know? Like.
Right. Well, I think maybe, you have to guard against, you know, the thing where you're seeing the same people to trade with every week. So get out of your comfort zone, you know, go, and you know, I don't know the situation. I don't know how many LGSs there are there or how many are actually, you know, in a reasonable travel distance. But if at all possible, try to go to some other stores. I mean, even if it takes you some time to get there, maybe once a month, try somewhere new. You know, that's great both for, you know, meeting people and, you know, forming some connections and all of that good stuff. But, you know, it also gives you some new binders to be put in front of you.
Or go to Dirtle Night, you know, like if people are playing casually, get invited to that. You can host that. There's all kind of stuff you can do. You just need to be where people are, and you can actually make more money than trading with strangers if you were the guy that hooks people up. You know, people know that you're the guy to get cards from. Even if you're having to order cards online to hook people up, if you get that reputation, people will come to you. They'll bring their friends to you. Like, if you can be that guy, then that's a pretty good way to deal with your situation also.
All right. Well, there we go. Thank you for the emails, guys. Keep them coming. I think we've actually done pretty well recently at reading them. So I promise we will continue to do that.
But now we're going to move into Picks of the Week.
It's time for the Pick of the Week.
Pick of the Week.
Yay! All right, I'll kick it off. Well, no, wait, we got a guess here. Eric, what's your pick of the week?
All right, so I got a boring one, and I got a more interesting one.
Yay!
So the boring one I'll just go over quick.
Boo!
I think you guys – man, you're not a bad news first kind of guy. Get it out of the way.
All right, tear that Band-Aid off.
All right, so you guys have mentioned it on previous podcasts, but it's Sylvan Carry added. I've been sitting on a bunch of copies since before Born of the Gods was released. And, you know, I think it's fairly obvious that that card's poised to move once rotation happens. Even before we knew that, you know, Cons was going to be a wedge set, that card's just super powerful. And, you know, I picked it up at anything under six, I think. So, yeah, that's my boring one.
That was going to be my pick of the week. So I wish you hadn't called it boring because I was excited about it.
Okay, well, you can give me some more insightful financial information about it.
Sometimes the logic is that simple. Everyone's talking about Mana Confluence, and everyone's talking about Soldier of the Pantheon, including me. I won't shut up about that card. But, yeah. I mean, Sylvan Caryatid was sort of under the radar. I think if you were a player, you definitely want to pick that up. Because I don't know how much money you're going to be able to make if you buy in now around like 8 to 10, but you could definitely end up paying more later and regretting it. So I would definitely absolutely get them now if you're planning to play with them, and maybe more than the playset you need.
But so Jason, you suggested that I might pick a card that is a little unconventional. It's not on everyone's radar, but as far as cubing goes, something that I've been doing over the past 2 years is converting anything in my cube that could be alpha or beta to alpha or beta copies. As, you know, pimping your cube is something that will happen almost inevitably if you own a cube. Marcel, talking
yeah.
to you.
Yeah, I know. I want to stay away from that.
Okay, so the good pimping is convert your copies to alpha or beta, because it doesn't even take that long. I swear to God, I'll pick up an alpha or beta copy of a card, and like the next week, the card has gone up. And so, I mean, it's just worked out really well as a way to both pimp my cube and invest into my cube. Like, I'll just give you an example. Like in my common uncommon cube, I picked up a Demonic Tutor beta maybe like a year ago, and it's already like doubled in price.
Hey, that's fair enough. I mean, it's you get to have an investment that you get to have fun with. You know, how many people get to say that with their stocks and their bonds? They right. get to look at them. No, you get to play with your cube. Yeah, hey, I can stand behind that.
Right. And I love foils, but, you know, foils do degrade if you play with them a lot. And unlike foils, alpha beta cards tend to hold up to play pretty well.
Sweet. Hey, so what do you think about the new frame? I've actually, like, I like old borders, but more than anything else. But as I've gone through my collection, I started to look at it. I like the new frames better than the modern frames. So I used to like the older versions of cars, but I'm actually going to upgrade anything that's an M15 frame to that. Yeah.
I dig the new frames. I think there's like pros and cons to each. If I had to pick, I would say that like, not alpha beta frame, but old border foils are just like the prettiest to me.
Yeah, without a doubt.
It's going to be hard to match stuff going back also.
Yeah.
Like there's going to be less continuity in your cube if you go for the new M15 border on everything. But I mean, you're not going to be able to, if you're playing with anything post M15 only, it's not all going to match anyway, so.
Yeah, I don't care about matching. Like,
well then.
Yeah, being pretty, I want to try to make sure that if something does happen to this cube that, you know, I'm not going to lose my shit. So, I mean, do you insure your cube or how do you do that?
I mean, I have homeowner's insurance and you can cover your cards under that. You're not going to get the full amount back if anything happens, but you can get something.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's feels like a topic actually we should tackle in a future episode, because I imagine it's pretty relevant for a lot of players.
Yeah. I'll do my research and I'll come back with a whole stack of information. We'll do that. All right. So my pick of the week is going to be...
If it's my second pick of the week, I'm going to lose my shit.
Actually, I forgot what it was. Go ahead, Jason.
Right. So I don't get scooped again. I'm giving up. All right, guys. I'm sick of waiting for Chasm Skulker to be a bulk rare. It's not going to be a bulk rare. I don't know if it's going to impact Standard. I never really thought it would, but everybody who plays Standard more than I do, for some reason, really thinks that Chasm Skulker could or will be a thing. If there's, I don't know if people are going to draw three cards with Jace's Ingenuity. I don't know if they think there's going to be a Planeswalker. Just on speculation, Chasm Skulker is actually up $1 from its historical low, and its historical low is like $1.50. So if you can get these under $3 now, get a playset at least. Like, I was really thinking this would hit bulk, and then I'd scoop a bunch of them, because as an EDH player, I'm like, well, I play Lore Scale Coital, and this is quite a bit better than that. So I was just like, all right, Lore Scale with upside, no-brainer. But I don't know, the price is just out of control. I'm really, I don't know, I shouldn't be surprised, because if I think it's a good card, other people are going to think it's a good card, probably, but I didn't really think Standard. I was thinking EDH pretty much only, and I don't know if EDH is making this a $3 card right now. So nah. If you can get these under $3, go to town.
This is Standard. I was seeing this at on the set review that we did. I like this card a lot. And it's 70 cents on Moto, and like that's a good deal. Like this card will impact Standard. I had one of these in the when we played the block at the GP Portland, and that card did not stay on the board for that very long at all. It was a hot target, so I mean... when I did have it on there, it eventually became a 13-13, that no one wanted to kill. So the card could do serious work. So I fully get behind that pick. And so my pick of the week is going to be, Jace, the Living Guild Pack. I just don't think he's going to, the same thing with you, the Kevin Sulker. I don't see him going to bulk, and I don't think his price is going to get any better. He's, $475 online, and he's about, $950 in paper. I'm sure at some point this guy is just going to be a major player, and this is probably about as cheap as he's going to get. So if you want to get your play set, get your play sets. If you want to go in a bit deeper, I definitely don't think this is a bad way to put some money in. So, post rotation, and we'll see how that works out. And if not, it could be, you know, later on down the block, but I know Jace is going to definitely be worth your money.
All right. I will jump in. I'm going to start this with a little throwback to What's It Worth. Do you guys know what a foil Karanos God of Storms is worth?
Stupid modern.
The card is $65.
Wow.
I was actually going to say 70, and I was going to say that as a joke.
Yeah. It's $65. I bought one of these last week and found that out the hard way. $65 for foil Karanos. Regular Karanos is $8 and going up. Just starting to tick up. It's a third set. We're done with Journey. We've talked about it before. I don't know if Karanos will get played in Standard a lot. I do know that it's played some in Modern, and I know that the foil price is, what is that, 8 times more than the non-foil right now?
That's too many more, for
that
sure.
Something there is wrong. That's for sure. It's a god from a third set. I can't imagine that this isn't $15 in 18 months, and that's even looking at that.
So your pick's the non-foil?
I like the non-foil.
He is the most expensive card in Journey to Nyx on Moto. He has now eclipsed his pre-sale price, pre-release price. There you go. Thank you, Corbin. Yep. So his steady climb. So definitely this guy I see in play, and that's a solid pickup.
Yeah, I like the foil. I mean, you know what? The foil at 65, if it's 65, it's probably not going to be less than 65 moving forward. Even if it were somehow to be reprinted in an extra product, it's probably not going to be the foil printing, you know? The foil is probably fine. But in terms of, not many people out there, I think, are speculating on $65 cards who listen to our casts. I think people are much more likely to be able to trade for some Karanos at $8 in anticipation. Because if it sees any standard play, it's going to immediately hit 15, and it's going to probably eventually hit 15 regardless. So
should they trade for them aggressively?
Yeah. Sure. So I would trade mildly aggressively.
I think all the wedge colored gods have a high likelihood of doing very good things. Just my suspicion.
Fair. Yeah. I mean, I agree. I'm straying away from standard a little bit, I think, this week for my pick of the week. I know I've mentioned the card before, but Restoration Angel. The card is $5 to $7 on TCG Player. Again, we've talked about it. There's going to be at least one morph card to go with this. Pick them up now. Don't wait for suddenly the card to be spoiled here in the next couple of weeks, and then everyone to race in to get the Restoration Angels. Just pick up however many you want now. At least your playset, you're going to want them. There will at least be some deck that will, be a flash in the pan at the very least. And even if you decide you don't want to play that deck, then your Restoration Angels went up in price. And if you do decide you want to play that deck, or if it actually turns out to be a real thing, then you're going to want to have those Restoration Angels.
Ryan, what do you think is behind the fact that, Restoration Angel was $5. It was obviously a good pickup. Then it went to 10. Since then, it's come down to about 8. What do you think, it seemed like one of those cards that would be that was kind of like a no-brainer, this is going to keep going up card, and it hasn't done that. What do you think has led to that?
I think a lot of it is just the Modern settling this year. We do have to remember that that card has 2 printings, and one of them was given out to every player who showed up to the FNM. I even went to that FNM because you got a free card that was already 10 at the time, or 12, 15 at the time, whatever it was. And I think that's hurt it a little bit. I think people started looking at their Modern going, maybe I don't need all these kind of fringe playable cards, and maybe sold some of that external stuff off once they knew what deck they were going to be playing. And I think Restoration Angel is probably just one of those cards that got hurt from that. It hasn't been seeing nearly as much tier 1, deck play over the past, you know, couple of months as it was when it was, huge and, you know, like in, I think it was last year in Modern, right? That there was two different decks that were playing it. And really, it's like, I haven't heard about those decks doing a whole lot this year. So I think that either the metagame's changed a little bit or, you know, just the natural progression of, Modern itself. Like, I think we've seen a lot of these cards. We're not always focusing on them, but there really has been a lot of cards in Modern overall that have dropped, you know, maybe this 20% or so. And it's just the format stabilizing itself. I don't think it's negative against Restoration Angel in any way. I think that's just one of those peripheral cards that kind of got caught up in that. And I think that's great for the speculators now because, you know, with morph being a thing, like I said, there's not going to not be a card. Like, there's going to be something you want to morph or cheat over. So, yeah, that's my pick.
Oh, if there's a card that we're staying away from also, I think I said before that I didn't like Nykthos going into a wedge set. I like it even less. We were talking on Twitter. I forget who I was talking to on Twitter, but somebody's like, so what do you think is going to be in the multicolor Commander 2014 stuff? I was like, or the monocolored stuff. I was like, oh God, all the Commander 2014 decks are monocolored. And, last time every Commander 2013 deck had a command tower. I'm thinking that Nykthos might be a pretty good candidate for taking that slot because you're not going to want to give people command towers in a one-color deck. So I'm thinking that Nykthos could be in that commander supplement, and that makes them even worse than they are right now. So
that would be a very bold move.
When are these set to release?
November, I believe.
Okay, I think you wait till after we see cons. I'm not going to count Nykthos out. I really think that even though we're going into edge block, there's going to be some mono-color decks that are just like, you know, mono green splash black or whatever.
Yeah, I think mono green is the one that might break through.
There's going to be something. Like, don't sell the card right out. I don't think it's going to drop so drastically immediately after rotation that you're, you know, going to lose a ton of money on it. And there is always the potential upside. And I think the card's just kind of been holding steady lately because nobody really knows what's going to happen to it. So if it does see that initial play right off the bat, I think that will allow it to spike a little bit. Well, I don't know that you're going to be able to make any money off of it. I wouldn't go buying into any copies by any means, but I don't know that I would fire sale them at my first chance either.
Right? Well, I think Jason's right that, nothing. No, I just lost whatever I was thinking.
Oh, that's perfect. Can we leave that in?
Yeah, I think Jason's
right. Nothing.
I just lost whatever I was thinking. I had a good thought and then it was gone. However, the point I want to make, I forget where the intro was going with that, but where the point I actually want to make is, I'm just going to start over. Like Jason was saying, I think that the reprint risk there is kind of the thing to worry about. Because on the other hand, you know, it's a non-basic land that has a unique effect in the game that no other card has. And those sort of things, typically hold up pretty well and tend to break through. So, you know, if it's reprinted, obviously that would destroy it. But otherwise, I mean, it seems, you know, pretty safe.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny that I'm like petitioning for this card now as when it first came out, I thought it was a pile of garbage, but whatever. We're all wrong about things.
All right. So Eric, where can they reach you at?
Well, for commission requests, you can always reach me at my email, eaklug@gmail.com. Or you can always, you know, tweet at me, klug_alters, or reach me on Facebook. And I mentioned that at the beginning of the cast.
Yeah. And there you go. So you got that. I think we're running a little long on this episode, so we're going to end it abruptly and short. So tune in next week for more of this Brainstorm Brewery goodness. Later. Brainstorm Brewery is brought to you by GatheringMagic.com and CoolStuffInc.com. Show your support.